Take a network break, grab a pumpkin spice latte and throw it in the trash, and join us for our virtual donut feast of tech news analysis. I'm Drew Conroy Murray. Greg Farrow is here. Before we get to the news, I want to mention our sponsors. Today's show is being sponsored in part by ExtraHop, the leader in real-time IT analytics. The ExtraHop platform provides insight across the IT environment, helping IT leaders make data-driven decisions to optimize performance, security, and customer experience. Tweet at ExtraHop and mention Packet Pushers to get a free t-shirt, and you can learn more about ExtraHop at extrahop.com/demo. Network Break is also sponsored by InterOptic. You can purchase high-performing optics designed by engineers who truly understand what you need at a fraction of the cost. Get more information at interoptic.com/packet-pushers. And tune into Packet Pushers weekly show 360, and you can hear InterOptic CEO Tim Dixon as he opines about transceivers, the Shannon limit, and the future of optics in the data center. It's a good nerdy show. Last but not least, learn what you can do to better design Wi-Fi in the enterprise environment and also what you should avoid doing. Join Greg Farrow and IBWave for a free webinar on October 31st, and we'll have sign-up details in the show notes. Okay, to the news. Cisco has announced two new service offerings called Business Critical Services and High Value Services. The announcements came wrapped up in a lot of fear-mongering about IT skills shortages and digital transformation, and I'm not really sure what they do.
Me either. Next.
I read the press release. I read the blog a couple of times, and I'm like, okay, but what? What do they do? What do I get?
I mean, there's two articles. When Cisco releases a new product or a new strategy, they usually revolves a press release, which goes off to the newsroom, the Cisco newsroom, and then there's usually an executive in charge who releases a blog post. I don't know about you, but when I read them, I just went like, what? There's like all of this bombast and bloviation and, you know, the world is changing and business suite of predictive services and, you know, and there's a fancy video and there's like, and I'm like, yeah, but what are you selling? Where's the technology angle here?
Do you know? It's exactly like, right. Yes.
Is that what you got it as well?
That's exactly what I got out of it as well. Yes. And for good measure, they also threw in some stuff about AI just because you have to.
Well, I don't know. It's just like a portfolio of services designed to put IT departments back in the driver's seat. Okay, right? Got that. Powered by AI. Okay, Cisco doesn't have an AI. As far as I know, it hasn't acquired anything in AI in the enterprise IT arm, which is where this is coming from.
And I sort of wondered, like, if they're talking about services, if there are these, you know, people rolling up to your business to help you out, are they bringing, like, some giant supercomputer with them? They're going to plug it in and be like, boop, beep, beep, beep. Okay, we've diagnosed what the issue is.
Yeah.
I don't know. Maybe, I don't
really
know.
It doesn't really say. It just says, we've got these services. They're going to reduce complexity and cost, reduce risk, and accelerate business agility and transformation. Okay, well, every press release that I've read this year right. says exactly those three things. So we copied and pasted that from somebody else, right? That's great. No problems. We can skip over that. But it doesn't actually tell me what these services do or what they cost or what they are or just there's a name, Cisco Business Critical Services and Cisco High Value Services, and that's it.
Right. And given that there's two different services, I'm assuming it's two different tiers of pricing. But again, who knows?
Mm-hmm. Oh, and it also mentions Cisco Optimization Services, which is a separate product,
right.
which is a one pager from IDC. I can't imagine how much that cost. So I am struggling a little bit here, but I did keep digging, and eventually I've had a look at the news, and I sort of started to, you know, do the arcane, throw the words on the table and read the bones. And I think I've kind of got it here. So let me give you the sort of the nut from Cisco. Cisco said, today Cisco is launching two new additions to the services portfolio, Business Critical Services and High Value Services. These two new services offer the power and intelligence of AI and machine learning to optimize IT talent, knowledge and skills and allow organizations to solve their problems first and ultimately get closer to their end user customer. All right. Now, there's not a lot of detail in there, really, is there?
There's a lot of words. A lot of words, not a lot of information.
So the only thing that I can get out of this is that Cisco's basically giving up on letting resellers provide services. I think what we're seeing is that customers are saying our networks aren't working properly. We can't get the right staff who can make the networks work for us. We're paying a fortune for Cisco products, and they just don't deliver an ROI. And I think that's partly what's driving the switch to open source and white box is that, sure, I can go and buy Cisco, but if I'm going to pay this high price, what am I getting from Cisco that's special or unique?
Mm-hmm.
And I think Cisco needs to address that. So what they're saying now is we're going to use artificial intelligence and machine learning to start adding services on top of our switches. In other words, resellers, you didn't make the grade. Customers can't do it themselves, so we're going to start getting in here. And this, I think, is a really significant transition. This is basically an admission that the resellers don't survive much longer. And I've been saying that for a while and sort of pointing out different things, but I think this might be a milestone. And what I want to point out here is that every IT company is steadily getting rid of the middleman. So the role of resellers is getting smaller and smaller every single year, and the profit margins that resellers make. Now, in particular, what I would say to you is that most resellers struggle to stay alive for very long. It's a really thin margin business that doesn't have a lot. And what we see is that resellers last 4 or 5 years before they go to the wall. They usually mismanage their cash flow at some point, and it's usually related to professional services. So if you go out and you sell like $1 million worth of tin, you know, of routers or switches or servers or, you know, whatever it is, the only place where you can give yourself a competitive advantage between you and the next reseller is by reducing the price on your professional services. Any reduction in price on professional services means you either deliver it wrong, you have cheap professional services or untrained or lack of them, they don't deliver on time, they don't deliver on budget, they're too stressed, a whole lot of things, right? And so at the end of the day, you've bought this really expensive car, but you've got nobody that can drive it, which is a common story I've used, right?
Yes. So let me see if I can track all this based on what you're saying. You're saying, Cisco is saying, we understand customers are upset that they're spending a lot of money on networks that don't seem to be doing what they thought they were going to do, or can't get the full value out of them. So we're going to come in and help those customers get that value, which is going to edge out the resellers whose job this is supposed to be.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. So they're going to put software in, which is going to use machine learning, and they're going to extract the configurations of your device. You know, we've talked a lot about formal verification models. Cisco's talked about tetration for telemetry. We've got other companies doing intent-based networking like Apstra, of course, which has been really big on Packet Pusher's network. How does Cisco differentiate themselves from all these other companies? Cisco doesn't want to keep going out and keep buying up all the other people in the world. They're running out of money, basically. You know, it's not profitable for them to keep throwing money into the enterprise. Remember, 9 consecutive quarters of decline overall. But in the enterprise IT, they've been had 9 consecutive quarters of decline in enterprise IT as customers basically defect somewhere else, right? Or stop buying or move something to the cloud or don't need as much or, you know, whatever the purpose is, the answer is. So I think what they're saying is we're going to put some software out there that's going to do some machine learning, which is going to have it. Now you think about, what are you going to do if you've got some fancy spancy software platform? Let's suspend belief for a minute and actually assume that Cisco can build some software of quality that people will pay for, right? Not just the hardware with the software on top. Let's assume that Cisco can do that. I think you're going to start to see a Cisco that looks at the configurations on switches and starts to say, this is a misconfiguration, this is a misconfiguration, this device isn't being used properly,
yeah,
this is insecure, this is a bug, this is a problem. And then they're going to say to customers, okay, now we've got a situation where something's not right, okay? And keep in mind that this is going beyond what they already do with sales. A lot of people are already using monitoring platforms. So a lot of what Cisco's offering today is Cisco will do your asset management for you. And that just feeds into the sales organization. Literally, like, you know, customer X has 6 Nexus 7000s. Well, that's end of life. We need to send it, you know, look at their watch. Time to send in a sales team to upgrade them. You know what I mean?
Yep.
So a lot of the data that's been collected up till now has been driven by smart sales. So if I have a list of assets that you have and, you know, I've got a list of all the software licenses and I've got them sitting, then I can actually go to send my salespeople in to say, are you ready to upgrade them?
It essentially kicks off a calendar appointment to set up a sales meeting.
But what we've seen with formal verification is that you can now start to use mathematics to do analysis of the network architecture, find the network, determine it, and then start to look at what's broken. So is the cost configuration correct across all of the switches? Is the firewall rules doing what you think? How many firewall rules are unused? Now, if Cisco can do all of that, where's the role of the reseller? If the reseller is doing a less than perfect job, let's say a second-rate job, does Cisco go in and say, well, according to our platform, you suck at professional services.
Right.
See you later. Like, we've looked at all the customers that you've sold this stuff to, and your people really aren't doing a very good job for our customers, so we're going to put in another reseller who's going to do a good job. And pretty soon it's just going to be, well, why don't we do the whole thing from the cloud anyway? I actually think this might be the end of – now, Cisco's going to sit there and say, no, we love our – because short-term revenue relies on resellers. Cisco's – business model relies on resellers taking their products in, but I think that's coming to an end.
Well, it's interesting that the press release that announced this, the official press release, has quotes from several resellers lined up to say how wonderful this is going to be for resellers. So using the marketing judo that's going on here, yes, maybe that is also the death knell.
Yeah, well, who else? You know, for these people, I mean, a lot of Cisco resellers, a lot of IT resellers are what we call box shifters. So their job is to say, you know, you want to buy a thing, give me the SKU and I'll sell it to you at 10% and, you know, cash flow, cha-ching, get the money, get the hell out sort of thing. And Cisco doesn't want that. Neither does HPE or Dell. So everything I'm saying here about Cisco applies to other people, all the other suppliers too. Cisco's just the topic of the day here because the press release came out and it was just so arcane, so weird. I think the point here is that the internet removes middlemen. It doesn't really matter where you are on the internet. The whole purpose of cloud is the days of car maker makes cars, gives them to a wholesaler who ships them around the world to car dealers. Car dealers then put them on the retail show floor and then company, and then the customer goes to a car dealer to buy a car. That's the old supply chain. And then along comes the internet and companies like Tesla go roll it off the factory floor, deliver it to customer.
Yep.
Right? There's no need to have stock sitting on the show floor when you can take it straight off the production line and send it to the customer. And the internet destroys that whole chain, right? And we've seen Amazon do the same thing to Walmart, and all the retail chains in the US are all down, you know, huge amounts of numbers. Neiman's, is that one over there?
Yes, it is.
You know, those types of, you know, malls and everything are suffering because people would rather buy it from Amazon and just get it shipped straight. And like Amazon just has a warehouse full of stuff. A lot of vendors just take their stuff, drop it straight into Amazon's warehouse, and then ship it straight to the customer. Same thing, same model that Tesla's using. And I think the same thing is coming here. It's going to creep in very slowly. Nobody wants to upset the profits in the short term, but in the long term, that's the way it has to go. Customers are going to go straight to the vendor and buy what they want, and it's going to turn up in their premises, and then it's going to link back to the vendor, who's going to have a cloud platform that's going to manage and operate it for you, and then they're going to force you to operate it, and it's going to look like a cloud, even though it's going to be on-prem. And if you think about hyperconverged is the ultimate extension of this. If you go out and buy a hyperconverged Cisco platform or a HPE hyperconverged or a Dell hyperconverged, what's left for you to customize?
Not much.
Not much. You know, a couple of extra disk drives, you know.
Right, yeah. Maybe you tweak the interface to give you your favorite report, but that's about all the customization you're getting. And frankly, that's the whole point, right, is that you're not supposed to tweak and fiddle with a bunch of nerd knobs and have to do all this integration work. You just want a stack that's together and running as soon as you plug it in.
Yeah, and so I basically think that what we're seeing here is this: Cisco is now going to be watching over your shoulder. They're going to see your infrastructure. We already know that it's possible for people to suck data out of switches and routers and firewalls and build models of them. So if you take that a step further, what if the vendor now starts to use that to detect if resellers are, if my Cisco infrastructure isn't working optimally? We saw the Starship project. What was it called? Cisco Star. We talked about that a few weeks back, where they start monitoring UCS servers in the cloud.
I was just going to mention that. Yeah, they just announced a monitoring and management system from the cloud for UCS that they're rolling out. Yeah, so that seems like the tip of the spear maybe to push this over into the network side as well.
Yeah. So now all of a sudden, why doesn't Cisco just deliver the whole thing and manage it for you and operate it for you? And the resellers, well, you know, where's this place for resellers in all of this?
Right. It's certainly significantly reduced. I think there are people who have good relationship with resellers. If you're a good reseller who has skill sets and expertise that your company relies on, there's still, I think, a place for them. But in general, I take your point that it does seem like Cisco is going to make it harder for middlemen to find a value proposition for customers. If they can come in and say, we're going to do the optimization, we're going to do the monitoring, and, you know, we'll even send maybe a team in from Cisco onto your site to help you.
Yeah, now that team may actually come from a reseller, but it would be under Cisco's control.
Right, and Cisco will cash the check, yeah.
And that already happens today. So the last thing they talked about, there's one part of here, but they talk about the skills gap. They say most people can't act. And basically what it's saying is, you know, Cisco's new services offering will truly help our customers free up time to focus on the growing IT talent gap and remain competitive. In other words, I think this is an admission that the current generation of products are complicated, hard to use, hard to operate, hard to whatever, right? And if only we could make them work, then our customers might want to pay more money for them, or pay some money for them, instead of us shrinking away to nothing.
Isn't it kind of gutsy for Cisco to say, we've made this so complicated to use that we've got a new set of services we can sell you to decomplicate it?
Exactly, which is pretty much my view. Has been my
That takes some stones.
Well, I don't think they even think about it like that. They would think of that complexity as, you know, responding to customer needs.
Sure, every customer's of course. Need. Yeah.
They would convince themselves that this is how it should be, if that makes sense. Because customers asked us for that feature, we gave them that feature, now the product's more complicated. Or instead of simplifying products to keep the operational costs low, it's in their interest for the operational cost to be high, because that justifies a higher cost of production, of selling the product, right? There's actually sort of like this vicious circle. Any company which is focused on sales instead of technology tends to start looking at ways to sell stuff instead of how it actually is a good idea. So one way to make the sales process more successful is to make it complicated. So we've got this complicated software licensing. We've got complicated products, thousands of SKUs and different options and configurations, which, you know, the rest of the industry is going against. You know, at the hyperconverged layer, you don't get to choose and hand build your Lego block IT infrastructure. You buy this and it's validated, and Azure Stack comes on that.
Yep.
Right? and you don't get to choose your favorite server and your favorite hard drive and your favorite memory module from your favorite whatever it is. You just get what you get and you suck it up and start using it. I think the sales culture that we've got ourselves into in IT is collapsing, and we're starting to see the switch back to technology where it's not about selling, it's about making it work. And this is exactly. This is a harbinger.
Yeah. Yes, I think so. All right. Well, we've got the links to the Cisco press release, the Cisco blog, and Greg actually just wrote up a quick story about this, which we'll also link to. A lot of information. Go digest it. Think about it. We've got other stuff to talk about, so let's move on. This is also along the lines of the changing business environment for our beloved legacy vendors. HPE is, I guess, exiting the cloud server business partially. They announced recently that they're going to stop selling commodity servers to big cloud scale companies. That's the Googles and the Amazons of the world. And of course, the reasons you can guess, sales volumes are high, but profit margins tend to be very, very thin. Cloud giants can go directly to ODMs themselves and get the custom devices that they want. Not a great business model for HPE. However, HPE says it's going to continue to sell high-end server platforms like the ProLiant line to any cloud company that wants them, but they're going to step out of that commodity market.
So this goes back to, I think it was 4 or 5 months ago, HPE had a nasty knock when a tier one cloud provider, probably Azure, stopped buying their servers.
Right. The people think it's Microsoft that just didn't buy enough servers from HPE to give them a good quarter. Yeah.
And I said to you, I don't see why these companies would buy servers from HPE unless they've got some sort of value to add. Conclusion, they have no value to add.
Right.
Right. So if we don't see any of the big cloud providers buying Cisco's UCS. We don't see them now. We know they don't buy HPE. Dell has a cloud business that it sells to certain ones, but it doesn't sell to the big four. It sells to people in the different era. I think, you know, companies like eBay and Dropbox and stuff like that. But that's just because Dell does some of the warehousing, not so much the servers. So I think this is kind of like an admission to the fact that clouds can do it all themselves if you're big enough or if you want to. You don't need a branded vendor to do things for you. And this so-called innovation that these companies tout, you know, like their magic firmware or whatever, is actually not very valuable at a certain point.
Right. At a certain scale, yeah, there's less value you can extract from what you can just do yourself.
Yes, and I think anybody can actually do this. There are risks associated with white box and there are challenges, but, you know, whether it's a server or a switch or a storage array or whatever it is, I think that this is a sign that ultimately these branded vendors are going to struggle to stay relevant going forward, and they have to find. And this, again, is why Cisco's moving into this software stuff from the previous article is we can't sell servers to the cloud companies. They're not going to buy our routers. They're not going to buy our switches. They're not going to buy anything from us. What are we going to do?
Right. Right?
And if that starts to trickle down, which it is, we already know it has been for 5 years now, that's going to change our business model. So I don't see any of this innovation that we're seeing from HP, Cisco, and Dell as being true, genuine market-leading innovation. They're being pushed to it as the market collapses underneath them. And if they don't move, you know, the bridge is going to fall out from underneath them and off they go.
Yeah, this seems like a gallant retreat from an unprofitable business.
Yes. Well, I don't think Meg Whitman wants to stand up in front of the shareholders again and say, yeah, no, the clouds aren't buying us.
Right. That's got to hurt a little bit.
Yeah. And she said, no, we're definitely going to get them back. We've got plenty of opportunities to sell servers to the. Oh, no, we can't. So she lied, I guess, you know.
Well, I was thinking good for her, you know, right? You see the writing on the wall. I think the one thing that she's been doing very well at HPE is cutting losses and saying, you know, this legacy business has to go. This business market isn't working out. Cut it. Let's try something else. Let's move somewhere else. Tip of the hat for her for recognizing the new environment she's in and trying to adjust accordingly. Whether long-term strategy works out, I think short-term, she seems to me to be making some smart moves.
Yeah. And I mean, throw Cisco. Now, Cisco is very good at announcing something that it's going to deliver in 2 or 3 years' time that it may or may not deliver. So HPE tends to be a little bit further back and wait until it's actually got a product that's ready to go. And it's usually 6 to 3 weeks, 3 months out. So, you know, I think most of what Cisco's announcing here is aspirational. I don't think it's real. But I think HPE is actually taking real practical steps to focus its business to where it wants to be.
All right, moving on. The big security news of last week was a set of vulnerabilities called CRAC in the WPA2 wireless encryption protocol.
Yeah, CRAC is spelled K-R-R-A-C-K. You probably heard about it already. Basically, the WPA2 protocol has been shown to be vulnerable to a fairly basic replay attack. It's not like you could drive a truck through this vulnerability like it was back in the days of WEP when you could just capture a handful of packets and you could decrypt it. This is a local attack that can get into the man in the middle and borg the crypto key exchange to force them to keep reusing the key, creating a theoretical vulnerability in the WPA2. So, it's not possible to trust the network. So you can never trust the network to be secure, whether it's a switch or a router or a Wi-Fi. The network can never be trusted. Your security has to be in your app. The devices need to be updated, mainly endpoints. I think there's like 7 vulnerabilities or 9 vulnerabilities in the client implementation and 1 in the infrastructure. So the world is not going to end, right? It's not that encryption isn't end. There's a very good article here from Matthew Green, who's a professor and widely respected cryptography advocate, that actually talked about what it is. But yeah, so far, Aruba got software patches available like straight up as soon as the thing came out. And notably, Cisco says they'll be ready when they're ready, and we'll let you know what's vulnerable in a week or so. Which was a bit disappointing, right?
It is a bit disappointing. Although it seems like, as you mentioned, the bulk of the vulnerabilities are on the client side, particularly around Android and Linux because of the WPA supplicant they're using. So if you've got a Linux or Android device and you're concerned about this, go update it and see if a patch is available. It sounds like patches are available for the client side.
Generally, the operating systems have been patched a while back, so Apple and Windows, and there's some Android phones which are just completely bogged. You know, the implementations are quite wide open.
Right.
I'm not going to go into the details. It's, you know, you need hundreds and hundreds of words to explain the weaknesses and stuff. I've put a link out to a blog post by Andrew Von Nagy, who's a well-known wireless expert. He does a good job summarizing it, and I also felt that Aruba had a brilliant white paper FAQ on this. Links are in the show notes. Go and have a read of it. They really explained it well.
Yeah, and we also have the link to the page from the original security researcher who discovered and published this. And a quick note to also say that he did disclose these vulnerabilities in a smart way, that he notified potentially affected folks and also the CVE organization, which started rolling out vulnerability alerts several months ago. So this is not a surprise to the industry. It's just news to us.
Yeah. So Matthew Green then went on to basically criticize the IEEE in his blog post.
Oh, you loved when people criticize the IEEE, don't you?
Yeah, well, I was going to pick up, but he basically has very detailed reasons. And he says, one of the problems with the IEEE is that the standards are highly complex and get made via a closed-door process of private meetings. That sounds familiar, doesn't it?
It sure does.
More importantly, even after the fact, they're hard for ordinary securities to research. I think I've said that before, too. So he's saying that even though these IEEE standards have been created, and often by people who have good skills and good talents, there's no way for normal people to get access to them. And this closed-door standards that are so universal should not be done by an organization like the IEEE, where everything's pay to play. So remember that to be a part of the IEEE, you have to pay to be a member. If you want to participate in standards, you have to pay more money. And then if anybody wants to read the standard, they have to pay to get access to those documents. And so it's not easy for him to go and review those. And he's not going to, basically, because if you make it difficult.
Right.
And
exactly.
As he pointed out, you know, people are now spending hundreds of millions to pick up a vulnerability in what was basically, he said, the handshake protocol and the encryption protocol are fine in isolation, but nobody looked at what happened when the two went together.
Right. Okay. That interaction. Yep. And that's how these kind of encryption related vulnerabilities usually work out. It's not the actual encryption algorithm itself. It's the implementation.
Yeah. So it's the old story, you know, deals that get done at the tennis club are not necessarily the best deals, you know, or the golf club. And the IEEE is effectively the golf club of our time for standards. And I doubt there's any will or, you know, whatever to change this process, but the IEEE is not the right place, in my opinion, for us to be developing standards that are just so foundational to the world at large.
Good point. All right. IEEE rant concluded.
Again.
I'm sure we'll be back, though. All right, take a brief break to tell you about one of our sponsors today, ExtraHop. They are the leader in real-time IT analytics and a pioneer of wire data. That's the window into digital transactions. They provide insight across the IT environment, from the data center to the edge to the cloud, helping IT leaders make data-driven decisions that enable them to optimize performance, security, and customer experience. And for a long time, IT has thought of the network as either the plumbing or the problem. But with ExtraHop, the network actually becomes your biggest source of real-time visibility for IT. That's because ExtraHop does the analysis first and then stores packets. And this creates wired data, which encompasses all interactions between IT systems and the organizations that rely on them. Wired data is rich, real-time, observed, and objective. And analyzing it at scale transforms the network from a transport function to the foundation of all digital experience. You can learn more about ExtraHop and try it for yourself at extrahop.com/demo. And you can connect with them on Twitter as @ExtraHop. And if you mention Packet Pushers, you can get a free t-shirt. ExtraHop, it's instant insight for IT. All right, back to the news. Huawei and China Telecom are announcing successful tests of 400 gigabit Ethernet.
Oh, this is going to turn into another kicking for the IEEE again. 400 gig E has only just been started in the IEEE. And here's Huawei doing successful 400 gig Ethernet standards, you know, work over distances of over 10 kilometers. Now, last time I checked on the Ethernet standards, the IEEE was basically saying you can't do 400 gig at 10 kilometers. Oh, okay. So I just wanted to flag that to you. Remember, I always keep saying that more bandwidth is just more bandwidth, and there's more bandwidth coming, and we've got vendors out there testing it. I know that Mellanox is also well down this path as well, but here's a press release from Huawei to talk about work they're doing in this space.
That's right. And also earlier this year in March, AT&T was also doing its own trials of 400 gigabit Ethernet, said they successfully transmitted 400 gig traffic between New York and Washington, D.C. So yes, the carriers and the device manufacturers are at work on this.
Yeah, they're not waiting for the IEEE.
No, they're not.
Unsurprisingly.
Here's a story that caught both of our attention, Greg. A new bill in Congress is proposing the idea of allowing U.S. companies that have been attacked to strike back via active defense mechanisms. The bill would give legal cover to businesses if they try to access the attacker system to identify the attacker and to destroy the stolen data.
Yeah, this actually sounds like the gun control debate to me. This is a very difficult
or
one.
Or lack of, yes.
Yeah, you know, moral issues about an eye for an eye. So, you know, if somebody invades my home, I have the right to shoot them sort of thing.
Yes.
Which works okay when you can actually define where home is. But in the case of hacking attacks, if you suddenly start to hack back against somebody based in a foreign country, you might have actually just committed a crime in that a cyber crime in a foreign country.
Right, because an attacker could cover their tracks and make it look like it came from one place when it in fact came from somewhere else. Well, here's Tom Graves. He's one of the bill sponsors, said in an interview on CNN, quote, "There's a lot of outlaws out there, but we don't have a sheriff, we don't have a deputy, and all we are asking for is a neighborhood watch." That's in fact not true, because cybercrime is still crime. We have law enforcement agencies that will take care of it or investigate. You know, if a bank gets robbed, the bank isn't allowed to go kick down somebody's door if they think they took the money and shoot up the place and take the money back. And why this should be applicable for cyberspace just boggles my mind.
Well, I've spoken to a few people in the security industry and, you know, listened to other people and read a lot of articles about IT security. And apparently hacking back is actually quite easy in some cases. You know, like if somebody steals your data and you can track back, you can quite often wipe the data because the OPSEC of these hackers tends to be fairly weak because they're not used to being hacked back. So I guess if you do it often enough, they'll just actually scale up, you know.
I guess.
But, the question is that a lot of these hackers are actually using somebody else's infrastructure. So imagine if a hacker actually launches an attack from AWS infrastructure that's using somebody else's resources. So they stole somebody else's AWS accounts. Then all of a sudden, you're burning up somebody else's money as you hack back.
Right.
Now you're actually in a legal nightmare that's got nothing to do with cybercrime. You've actually, you know, if you do a DDoS attack or you get into somebody's servers and start
just deleting data.
Yeah, and it's in somebody else's AWS account that's actually a running business. So imagine if JP Morgan hacked back and actually deleted Goldman Sachs' data.
I can see how, you know, somebody might think this would be, you know, sort of vigilante justice and very satisfying, but it just seems like the wrong way to go. We have enough security problems as it is. This is just going to cause more chaos and confusion and problems. And
yeah, it's one of these things where I think politicians can get cheap points.
Sure.
Just by making, you know, what sounds like, you know, on the face of it sounds like a good idea, but the reality is, I think even if they pass this law, I suspect that companies should be careful not even to do it because the legal ramifications are still pretty bad.
Right. Yeah. So we'll keep track of this, see if it actually makes it through. But the ideas out there, we'll have links to the story if you want to go check it out. Moving on, container pioneer Docker, they announced at DockerCon EU that they are embracing Kubernetes. That's the orchestration platform that competes with Docker's own Swarm Orchestrator.
Yeah, so I think we sort of said that Kubernetes, just a few weeks ago, I think we said that Kubernetes had won that war.
I mean, it's sort of an open secret that Kubernetes has kind of overtaken Swarm as the orchestration platform of choice. So this is acknowledgement by Docker that, okay, we're listening to the community, we're going to embrace this, we'll officially support it. We're not getting rid of Swarm. We'll still maintain it and run it. But if you want Kubernetes, it'll be integrated.
I think that strategically, this shows that open source projects can defeat commercial software. So in effect, Kubernetes has defeated the commercial Docker situation. And while Docker sort of made it fashionable to use containers both in and outside of enterprise IT, and particularly in enterprise IT, they've had a lot of success selling, making revenue. And they took another round of funding, I think, last week to value them quite highly up towards the $1 billion mark. The admission that Swarm is not going to be dominant, but Kubernetes will, basically sets them on a path to survival. A quick review of the sort of announcements that have run around this sort of suggests that Docker is now moving to fill the gaps in the weaknesses in Kubernetes itself. So they're starting to run a platform that sits over Kubernetes. So you'll now have Docker Swarm talking to Kubernetes, talking to containers underneath, and Swarm will do stuff for Kubernetes that is desirable in an enterprise environment. So Docker may well survive. But I think the interesting thing here is that an open source project with the right backers and structure can defeat commercial software at every turn. Again, and if you are a commercial software vendor, you must be peeved again to see software kill you out in the infrastructure space.
All right, another quick break to tell you about our other sponsor today, Interoptic. And Greg, you've talked with Interoptic. You can tell us a little bit more about them.
Oh, well, one of the things that you've realized when you start building data center networks is that more than half of the cost, somewhere around 60% of the cost, is actually optics. It's not the switches, despite what your switch manufacturer would have you believe. Your choice in optics really matter. And the only way to bring that cost down is to go with OEM optics. And when you go with OEM, you want a company that's going to stand behind the optics they sell and give you a better price at the same time. So Interoptic has a full product line of SFPs, and they stand behind it. They've been around for about a decade. We talked to them in the podcast that we had a few weeks ago. We had the CEO on, and he was telling us about his story. Since had a couple of people pop up and say, yes, we've been using them for a while. So that's not a bad recommendation. You need to do your own research. But most importantly, you need to know it, your supplier choice is important because SFP modules have code that needs to be updated. So today you might be using an SFP module in switch A, and tomorrow you might want to use it in switch B. You can actually reflash the firmware so that you can actually use it in both. So by choosing OEM equivalent optics from Interoptic at a fraction of the cost, you can still actually keep control of your optics purchase and use it as and when you need. So a lot of vendors today are actually saying, you have to buy this optic and it only works on this switch from this vendor. What you really want is one optic that works anywhere in your data center. And Interoptic is one of the companies that's meeting that need. You don't want to limit your optics from working in just one switch or the other. And as the demand from edge data centers, 5G and IoT comes, you're going to be overwhelmed with this sort of need to move your ports around and be more nimble at layer one. And so Interoptic supports that full range. As they say, from a hut in the Arctic Circle to the battlefield in Iraq, Interoptic has more than 4,000 customers across 7 continents.
Pretty good. Yeah, so you can visit interoptic.com/packet-pushers if you want more information to contact them directly and get a quote. You can also follow Interoptic on socials at @GetInterconnect. And of course, check out Weekly Show 360. That's an interview with Interoptic. Okay, back to the news. Last week, we had talked about Kaspersky AV software being compromised by Russian government agencies to serve as backdoors on U.S. government computers. Kaspersky has, of course, vehemently denied colluding with the Russian government. That hasn't stopped the fallout.
No. So, you know, brand damage. This is the nightmare that all CEOs have is once your brand is damaged. Although Equifax shows that your brand can be damaged and you can still stay happily in business and no one cares.
You still have a contract with the IRS.
Right. Well, that contract got taken back in the end, actually.
Oh, good. I didn't see that.
Yeah, it did get... So I think ultimately in this case where actually security doesn't live in the normal world of business where things actually work in a certain way. And I think that a burst of patriotism, the U.S., people in the U.S. tend to lean into a patriotic. And if they feel there's something that attaches their fervor for, you know, U.S.-made products, they'll use that. I think that that's basically what's happening. So people imagine that patriotism is a viable reason to go and buy US-made products while forgetting that most of the US products actually aren't very good in this particular case. And there's good reasons why you don't buy them. They're expensive and not the top of the market. Kaspersky's actually had one of the very best research teams for viruses and have been able to identify and be ahead of the competitors and find more. So it'll be interesting to see what happens here. I think ultimately, it's still my personal opinion, this is not a professional opinion, that Kaspersky's just been unwittingly compromised by the Russian spy industry in the same way that we saw other vendors be compromised by it. So NSA got into Cisco routers a while back, you know, and there are other things the NSA has done to got into US companies to make sure their software is out there. It's just a shame that a company has to go down. I suspect that Kaspersky may actually not be at fault here, but that doesn't stop the damage from happening.
Yeah, so the Kaspersky software has already been ordered off of all U.S. government computers, and retailers like Best Buy and Staples here in the States are actually pulling the software off their shelves. And we have a story from the Daily Beast saying that there are many U.S. corporate customers also dumping the software and looking for alternatives.
Yeah, that's what I mean. You know, it's a sort of sense of patriotism, and it's not necessarily unwise either, specifically if you know that the system's been compromised. You have to react, and you're probably being forced to react for industrial espionage reasons. So not much anybody could do at this point.
No. Okay, moving on. Fujitsu Network Communications, they have launched an SD-WAN offering aimed at service providers that want to sell SD-WAN services to their own customers. So Fujitsu is going to use software and appliances from Silver Peak. They'll run a multi-tenant SD-WAN orchestration software in their own NOCs, and then service providers can deploy branch and remote office appliances for their customers in partnership with Silver Peak. So a nice little win for Silver Peak there in this growing SD-WAN space.
Yeah, I wonder how many people do business with Fujitsu for managed WAN services. quite a few, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. This is the first time I've heard about this network communications business, but they say they have relationships with tier one through tier three and four service provider partners in the US. So
they're going to sell an offering to the service providers who then sell it on to a customer.
That's right. Yes, they are not the middleman, but I guess the top of the chain. And then the service providers use the service from Fujitsu and then resell it to their customers.
What could go wrong? Middleman inside of a middleman inside of a middleman.
It's turtles all the way down.
Turtles all the way down. This idea of carriers subletting services out to other people so they don't have to build them or operate them and just throw their hands in the air and say, it's not us. We don't run that. We just sub it out. It's a great win for Silver Peak. I think Silver Peak is a great product, so don't take it as that. But relying on a product from a carrier who's then sublet it to a services provider who's then using somebody else's product, that's a recipe for failure right there. You don't need a business that's got that many middlemen in the way.
Yeah, yes, you can. There are issues with that layering effect. But I think this is not the first time that Silver Peak has gotten involved in a deal with a third-party provider either. So I think there is also an appetite from the service provider markets who see SD-WAN encroaching potentially on their business to try to get ahead of this and say, wait, we've got an offering for you. It's SD-WAN. And they can get it to market quicker because they partner with Fujitsu.
Yeah, who then partner with somebody else who then, yeah. And I think just go and buy your Silver Peak directly, honestly. You'd be much, much more likely to have a successful result. And then you wouldn't be stuck with whoever it is that Fujitsu's customers are.
Right. Yeah, well, that's for everyone to make their own decision.
Might be a bit harsh, but, you know, I think the things that I've seen about SD-WAN is it's actually quite easy to manage. You don't really need to outsource it to make it work because they all have these cloud orchestration platforms. Mm-hmm. And, you know, simpler management and a modern approach to software, it's not tricky-dicky stuff like you used to be with routers. You don't need somebody who's got arms and legs in remote sites when all of your configurations are stored, monitored, visibility. Most of your problems are actually with the telco, not the actual routers and or the hardware devices themselves at the edge of the network.
Yeah, I agree. But again, I mentioned something like this earlier. There's always folks who just want to hand it off to somebody else. They want it to be somebody else's problem. And that's the area in which service providers and managed service providers play.
Yeah. And my story is, you know, if you want to treat your IT like it's a toilet that just needs to be cleaned, that's the results you pretty much get. I have no problems at all with letting, you know, outsourcing toilet cleaning because you can't actually, you know, it's really easy to measure it. You know what the good result looks like and it's straightforward, but outsourcing anything more complicated than toilet cleaning is always doomed to failure. That's my 25 years of learning right there.
All right. There it is. Very graphic. All right, our last story on that note.
I didn't even put a rude word in there. I did really well.
Oh, all right. Our last story is a show about a giant robot battle. There are two teams of builders, one American and one Japanese. They built giant robots to fight against each other in real life. These monstrosities, which weigh as much as 12 tons, were pitted against each other, and the results are up on YouTube in a big full production video. Spoiler though, if you're like me and you grew up watching giant robots fight each other in cartoons, the real world version is a little disappointing.
Well, I'll bet that your favorite soccer game or, you know, whatever game it is that involves chasing pigskin around a paddock started off as being fairly tedious as well. And this is how I see it. So this has been going on for quite some time. Are you not aware of this?
No, I've been aware of it. I heard about this a couple of years ago and you found this link and I think it was posted just recently and that they actually got these robots up and fighting.
Yeah, 17th of October this week. Yeah, there's a company in the USA called Megabots and another company in Japan, Tsudabashi Heavy Industry. And basically, I think the Japanese people are actually a robotics company. But anyway, and they basically have been throwing threats at each other for a couple of years now and building robots. And they finally got together to build these Megabots and go head to head and beat each other up. And this involves actually shooting like cannons and
right. They've got giant chainsaws and huge fists that grapple and
beating them with the grappling arms and a big slicer. It was actually kind of cool. But yes, the actual production itself was kind of, you know, it wasn't exactly.
It was a little overdone. Like they've got this guy who's kind of like a sports broadcaster, like coming up giant battle, and they kind of hype it up, and you're like, yeah, let's see it, and then it's sort of like. Here comes a 6-ton robot with a giant arm, and it knocked over the other 6-ton robot. You're like,
yeah, at 3 miles an hour. Right, yeah, it's a bit. It's about as. I mean, in that sense, they did overdo it. It's a bit like sitting in front of a. You know, you go to a conference and the keynote's kicking off, and they hire a bunch of pitch people to get up and hooray and lights and you know, put some fancy Las Vegas act up on stage, and then the the CEO comes out and goes, hello, everybody.
Exactly. Like, yeah, there was a little bit of that. Although I will say the fact that they actually got these things together and put them into the field is pretty cool. You can tell that a lot of work and effort has gone into these things, and give it a couple of years, this could be pretty awesome.
Oh, definitely worth a watch. You can see that if they continue and the way that we know that technology evolves over time. So these are manned battle bots.
Right.
And they are like, 20 feet tall.
They are physically impressive. Yes. That they are impressive.
And there's somebody
specimen.
Inside of them.
Right.
There really is somebody inside of them, yep. Operating them and driving them and wearing motorcycle helmets and hoping they don't get crushed to death, which I thought was really interesting. But
that's true.
Definitely worth the fun of a 10-minute watch. Skip over the hype from the rubbish, from the sports commentator who's trying to make a big thing.
That's right.
We could have done with less Americanism and more just, this is so cool.
Yeah, let the nerds take it.
Yeah, that's right.
All right, that brings us to the end of the show. Greg, where can folks find more from you?
People can find me. I'm getting more into expostulations of frustration and happiness on my Twitter account at Ethereal Mind. Still a couple of blogs coming out, sort of microblogging at etherealmind.com, but lots more long-form stuff at packetpushers.net. You should probably follow us in an RSS reader, I would recommend.
Yep. I'm Drew Conrimari. I'm on Twitter at Drew_CM, and I blog at packetpushers.net. Thank you to our sponsors, ExtraHop and Interoptic, and thank you for joining us for this episode of Network Break. If you like the show, please share it around with your friends. Tell people about it. That really helps us. Also, leave a recommendation on iTunes, because that also helps us. And if you are interested in getting more from us, like our newsletters, Human Infrastructure, and Link Propagation, just head on over to packetpushers.net/members, and you can sign up to get those for free. Thanks for listening.